This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2. You'll also find us online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. This afternoon, we're going to take a look at the life of Franklin Roosevelt. Born into wealth and privilege, he became an advocate for the downtrodden. How did Roosevelt become a traitor to his class? That's a question historian and biographer H.W. Brands takes up in his new book, Traitor to His Class, The Privileged Life and Radical Presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. H.W. Brands is our guest this afternoon. Listeners, you can join the discussion with a phone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. H.W. Brands is professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin. He is the author of more than 20 books, including Andrew Jackson, Lone Star Nation, and The Age of Gold. His book on Benjamin Franklin, the first American, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. His new book, Traitor to His Class, The Privileged Life and Radical Presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, is published by Doubleday. Again, the phone numbers, if you'd like to join us, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Brands, good afternoon.
Thank you. Delighted to be with you, Celeste.
On this date, March 4th, back in 1933, Franklin Roosevelt delivered his first inaugural address. How was it received?
It was taken as the first indication of what a new Roosevelt administration was going to do. In those days, the transition between the election in November and the inauguration in March was half again as long as it is now. And it seemed particularly long that winter because the American economy was at the depths of the Depression. There were soup lines. There were people living by the thousands on the street. The banking system was in free fall. And Roosevelt and Herbert Hoover, his predecessor, couldn't agree on anything important to do with the economy. And so the nation held its breath during these 5 months, waiting to see what this new administration would bring. And when Roosevelt gave his inaugural address, he did two things. One, he reassured the American people that all would be well. He gave his famous line about the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. But at the same time, and sort of almost contradicting that message, he likened the current emergency, that is the emergency then, to a war. And he asked for the kinds of powers that presidents as commanders-in-chief often receive during wartime. He asked for almost a blank check from Congress, and Congress, very shortly after the inaugural address, essentially gave it to him.
So he was, from the moment he was sworn in, he was up and running. Probably even before that, he was planning for that moment.
He had been planning for it, but strikingly, a lot of people found it very surprising that he took the strong measures that he took. People who looked at Roosevelt's background saw very little in his experience of government, or even to some extent in his campaign speeches, that would indicate the kind of radical transformations he had in mind for the American political economy. Now, to some extent, they weren't really paying attention if they were surprised, because Roosevelt did say a few things fairly early in the campaign season. They were fairly general, but that they were at the level of basic philosophy. And what he argued was that the American capitalist system required a firmer hand, firmer guidance from government, because when it didn't have that kind of firm guidance, it ran into the kind of crises that the country was experiencing at that point. And then when he became president, the New Deal measures that were implemented during his first 100 days, the famous 3 months that inaugurated his presidency, they really were pretty much outlined in his campaign speeches. But because people hadn't been paying particularly close attention, they were really more concerned with what the state of the economy was and what this new candidate was promising. They were surprised. And by the summer of 1933, at the end of the 100 days, a lot of people looked back just breathless on what had been accomplished.
Mm. In 1932, when he began, you know, the campaign in earnest, you write that he thought that that moment in time required balance, not going too far to the left or too far to the right. And while the New Deal created, you know, large and ambitious government programs, it was meant to kickstart the economy. So how radical was it?
It was radical in the sense of transforming Americans' expectations of government. When Roosevelt became president, the prevailing philosophy was that the economy was essentially separate from the government, and the economy went through its cycles of up and down, more or less autonomous from what public officials in Washington did. And if the economy was in a slump, as indeed it was during the 1930s, well, that was something that would just have to work itself out. People looked on the economy in very many respects like they looked on the weather. It had an important impact on people's lives, but there wasn't a whole lot you could do about it. Now, Roosevelt believed that, in fact, the government could have a strong and positive effect on the economy. In his thinking, the appropriate model was the First World War. Roosevelt had been in Washington. He was Assistant Secretary of the Navy during the First World War. And he saw how the government had essentially commandeered the national economy during the war in order to maximize the output of the defense industry, in order to make sure that American security was guaranteed. And Roosevelt saw how the economy had hummed along at maximal output during that time. And he thought that if the government took the same kind of strong action during the Depression, then it could achieve comparable results.
Okay, so mobilizing for prosperity.
And the result of this was that Americans, in part during the election of 1932, it was sort of a forward-looking endorsement of this philosophy, although it has to be said that Roosevelt's victory in 1932 was as much a rejection of Herbert Hoover as it was an endorsement of Roosevelt and his policies. But within a very short time, Roosevelt convinced the American people and a working majority in the American political system that this old notion that the economy was separate from government was outdated, that in fact the government needed to take a much more activist role in the economy, more precisely in the broader political economy. It needed to address the felt concerns, the hardships that the American people were suffering as a result of the Depression. So that was the first step. But in addition, it needed to try to pull the economy out of the Depression. This was something governments hadn't done. That hadn't been part of what was ascribed to the responsibility of government at that time. And furthermore, the government needed to take steps to make sure that when the economy did come out of the Depression, that another similar depression not recur. So Roosevelt radically transformed Americans' expectations, and ever since, Americans have held government responsible for what the economy is doing.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian and biographer H.W. Brands, author most recently of Traitor to His Class, The Privileged Life and Radical Presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon. Join our discussion with the telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now. A listener in Champaign. Hello?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. A few questions and statements, and I'll try to jumble them together. I've read a portion of the author's book. It's excellent. It's very thick, too. But I have a question. There's a lot of... I want to zero in on a book called New Deal, Raw Deal. I don't know if you've heard of that. It's another one of these attacks that on the New Deal and how it lengthened the Depression, so forth and so on. And the author constantly has... And I may have this wrong since I'm doing it from memory. One of Roosevelt's advisors, economic advisors, or I want to say Morgenthau, but I may have that
wrong. It was Henry Morgenthau, Secretary of the Treasury.
Okay. How he had so many grave doubts about the New Deal and how it was digging the country deeper into the New Depression. And I think towards 1938, there was an increase in unemployment, and the author maintains that Morgenthau maintains that Morgenthau stated that it's Roosevelt's policies, and I think he just narrows in. I think he ignores the context in which those policies occur. Also, there's an interesting chart in the book on worldwide statistics in terms of unemployment throughout the world. And the country that recovered the quickest in the Great Depression, according to that chart put out by the League of Nations, was Germany. And if I may say somewhat tongue-in-cheek, I'm surprised that Rush and his Republican allies aren't advocating policies of Nazi Germany. But the main thrust of my question is, what is your opinion on the idea that Roosevelt's policies actually worsened the Depression? And just to jump ahead, are we headed into another Depression? And what do you think of Barack's policies? And I'll hang up and listen off the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
These are some very interesting points that the listener raised.
Uh-huh.
The first I want to address is, this isn't the heart of his question, but it's a very important comment on Roosevelt's style of administration. Henry Morgenthau was indeed a skeptic of most of the New Deal policies, and he was constantly arguing that the administration needed to reduce the deficit to trim spending. The fact that Roosevelt kept him around and listened to him was an indication, I think, of Roosevelt's, call it his executive self-confidence. Roosevelt was the kind of leader who wanted to have dissenting opinions as close to him as possible. There are other presidents who want to get rid of the dissenters, and so that the administration can present a unified front. In Roosevelt's case, he wanted the dissenters within the administration so that they would serve as a check on those people, in this case, who wanted Roosevelt to do more. Now, the argument that the New Deal, in fact, lengthened the Depression is as old as the New Deal itself. Herbert Hoover, in fact, believed that he had found the key to ending the Depression by the time of the 1932 election. And there were some economic statistics that indicated things were turning a little bit up during the summer of 1932, now from a very low base, to be sure. And Hoover convinced himself that it was only the election of this radical Franklin Roosevelt that spooked investors, that caused people to pull back, and that kept the Depression going. Hoover and then his Republican supporters and Republicans since have then pointed at the New Deal, and they have pointed out that the New Deal did not end the Depression. In fact, the country was still in a depression as late as 1939. And they've concluded from that it was the New Deal that, in fact, extended the Depression. They have compared the Depression of the 1930s with economic recessions and downturns throughout the 20th century. And they've noted, correctly, that the Depression of the 1930s was the longest one. And they've concluded from that it must have been the New Deal that lengthened it. Now, there are a couple of things wrong with this line of reasoning. The first is that much of the comparison, the other recessions and downturns, occurred after the 1930s. And in fact, one can argue, I think, quite convincingly, that one of the reasons they were much shorter is precisely because of the regulations and safeguards that the New Deal put into place. Two in particular I'll point to. One is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, which tells bank depositors, don't worry if your bank starts to wobble. You don't have to run down and get your money because the federal government will make sure that you do get your money if the bank fails. As a result of this, there has never been a run on banks like there was during the 1930s. And this tends to limit the damage of financial crises. One of the striking things about the current financial crisis is that it's a crisis for bank shareholders who've lost lots of money, at least on paper, but it's not a crisis for bank depositors. Depositors haven't lost any money at all, and everybody can still get the money out of the bank. And that's a consequence of the New Deal. If not for the New Deal, then we would have had a recurrence of the bank crisis of the early 1930s. The second New Deal program that tends to counteract and shorten recessions is Social Security. Social Security is a counter-cyclical kind of program. Most people think of Social Security as old age pensions, but it's also unemployment insurance. And so when people lose their jobs, then Social Security makes payments. And so it puts a floor under overall demand and consumption. Okay, now having said that, the other thing about this argument that it was the New Deal that lengthened the Depression is it's a wonderful argument for the people who want to make it and who want to believe it because it's utterly non-disprovable. It presumes that, it takes as its premise, if there was no New Deal. Well, in logic, you can prove anything simply by falsifying the premise. So if you assume something that didn't happen, then it's impossible to disprove it. The last thing, and the listener raised this, the way out of the Depression for the various countries of the industrialized world was pretty similar from country to country. Germany pulled out of the Depression first. And the way Germany got out of the Depression was through massive deficit spending on military weaponry. Britain pulled out of the Depression second in about 1937. Same process, in this case, by rearming in response to German armament. The United States pulled out of the Depression in about 1940 by the same means, massive deficit spending on armaments. So if that lesson proves anything, it was the New Deal perhaps didn't end the Depression because it wasn't ambitious enough. The deficits that the U.S. government ran during the Depression were on the order of $2 billion. The deficits the government ran during the Second World War were above $20 billion. So it required that kind of injection of government demand to really pull the country out of the Depression.
And the caller also raised the issue of today. Your thoughts about the way out this time?
Well, it's really difficult to say. And this is one of the important differences between Barack Obama's situation and Franklin Roosevelt's situation. When Franklin Roosevelt became president, the Depression had been on in full force for over 2 years. The unemployment rate was 25%. Overall production was down 25 to 30%. The Dow Jones average was off 90%. Banks were failing by the thousands. There was a widespread perception that things cannot get worse, and therefore Roosevelt could do whatever he wanted. Roosevelt said in the campaign of 1932 that he was going to take an experimental approach. He said, we've got to try something. If it doesn't work, we'll try something else. But above all, we have to try something. Barack Obama, you could say, doesn't enjoy that luxury of being able to do anything, knowing that things can't get worse. Barack Obama's particular challenge is, well, he would like to be seen as the next FDR, but he has to be very careful, and I don't say this flippantly, but if he's not careful, he could be seen as the next Herbert Hoover, because there are Republicans out there who point out that the Dow Jones average is off about 25% since Obama was elected, and the unemployment rate has risen. I can just imagine that supporters of the Bush administration, the previous Bush administration, are keeping track. Okay, the unemployment rate on November 4th was 6%, and now it's nearly 8%. If it gets higher, then they'll be pointing the finger of blame at Obama rather than on the pre-existing conditions, just as Herbert Hoover and Republicans of his day pointed at Franklin Roosevelt. But they will probably, the critics today, will have a more plausible case if the economy continues to get a lot worse.
Hmm. Let's take some more calls now. Next, we're going to go to Charleston, Illinois, line 2. Hi.
Hi. In a similar vein, like you're talking about all of these, like, you know, how World War One and World War Two did some good things for our economy and everything. And I've been hearing that brought up a lot lately. That, like, that's not what's happening right now. Like in terms of like the Iraq War, that we're not that's not really doing us any favors for our economies. And I was wondering, like, is there something that we're doing wrong in that regard that you're aware of?
Well, if you want to put it this way, the wars that America is fighting right now are too small to have the positive effect that's required. As I suggested in describing the size of the deficits during the mid-1930s and then during World War II, if we want to get the same kind of kick out of government spending as during World War II, then the stimulus package that was just passed, which is on the order of $800 billion, should probably be about $5 or $6 trillion. It's going to have to be a lot bigger to get the same sort of effect on the economy that the U.S. got during the Second World War. Now, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen absent a major war, for the reason that when you're not in a wartime situation, the critics of much enlarged government spending can make a plausible case that this isn't a good idea. And right now, we're in a situation where the economists are dueling each other. Some of them say a much bigger stimulus. Some say, no, 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 it's too big as it is. And the political parties can line up and pick their economists, pick their experts. If the country goes to war, there's nobody who pushes back against higher government spending, because during wartime, you spend as much as you can, as much as you need to win the war. And to criticize spending on war is downright unpatriotic. In the absence of war, you can criticize higher government spending, and nobody can call you a non-patriot for that. They can just say you have a different opinion.
Let's take another call now. A listener in Urbana on line 1. Hi.
Yes, a couple of points. The first one, in comparing the Depression of 1933 to subsequent recessions and perhaps the current depression, I suspect a better model would be the collapse of 1836, which drug on until the, well into the 1860s. So that would be 14, 15, 16 years without any government intervention. Not a very pleasant thought. The other is that it seems that the expenditures for the Iraq War and the Afghan War, as you said, are comparatively small, but they also came initially at a time when the economy was booming along, and therefore were only inflationary rather than stimulative. We didn't need stimulation.
Yes, that's quite true, and in fact.
And the last question would be, is there a danger that Obama isn't going to be able to spend enough? Because it seems to me that his proposals, although the Republicans are decrying them as extravagant, are not nearly large enough to break the Depression. And there's the model of Roosevelt. He'd pretty well gotten the country out of the Depression in 36, but then he tried starting to balance the budget, and that caused a relapse. It seems to me that there's really danger of that happening again.
Well, these are all very good questions. This business of the cause of the recession of 1937 is, like most questions of historical and economic causality, kind of difficult. It is true that after 4 years of improvement in most of the data, for example, the unemployment rate went from 25% in 1933 to about 15 or 16% in the summer of 1937. And Roosevelt, who remained a fiscal conservative at heart all along, finally began to listen to Henry Morgenthau and said that, okay, the time has come to reduce the deficit. We can't continue to run these deficits indefinitely. And when he did reduce the deficit, he cut spending. And one of the things that happened just after that was a recession, the recession of 1937, which erased many of the gains that had been made in those previous 4 years. Mm-hmm. Now, it would be easy, perhaps too easy, to say that the recession of 37 was the direct consequence of this cutback in spending. There were almost certainly other things involved, and I wouldn't want to say that that was the sole cause of that.
I shouldn't care to infer that either.
Right, right. But nonetheless, there was this one thing that happened and the next thing that followed, so it's reasonable to draw that connection. I'm intrigued by the analogy to the 1830s on into the previous 15 years or so, the next 15 years. And here, this is where any historian, any honest historian, has to say that historical analogies can take us only so far.
Of course.
Because, and I would say, first of all, that anything that happened in the 19th century, especially before about 1890 or so, is only a very approximate guide, simply because the nature of the economy was quite different. But here I'll say even again that when I say that if the United States today wanted to get the kind of kick that it got in the 1940s, and so we would have to have a much larger stimulus package to achieve that, I don't have the nerve to say that, and therefore that's what it ought to do, because the situation of the United States within the American economy and the position of the United States in the world at large was quite different from the situation of the United States today. Because during the Second World War, the United States economy did indeed revive, but the United States took on an enormous amount of debt. Now, the reason it was able to pay down that debt in the years after the war was that the war had the effect of essentially obliterating America's industrial competitors. Now, in the absence of another such war, the United States, at the end of this recession, whenever it happens, is going to face some rather formidable economic competitors. Secondly, when the Depression began, and even more so at the end of the Second World War, the United States was the world's largest creditor. The world owed America lots of money. At the moment, the United States owes the world lots of money, and it's going to owe the world a lot more money by the time we come out of this recession. And so that changes dramatically the kinds of things you can expect from a stimulus package. And this is why, although I can say, here's what Roosevelt did, and here's what happened, and I can even say with some confidence, and here's why that happened, I don't have, as a historian, I don't have a great deal of confidence saying, and therefore, the lessons of Roosevelt apply at all directly to today.
May I contribute one other thing? We've been talking about 25 to 30% unemployment in the Great Depression. That is before Reagan rewrote statistical analysis, so that the 6% unemployment we had at the beginning of the year was actually considerably more. In fact, recently someone refigured things using the old, I think, legitimate standards and came up with a figure of 17 or 18% employment using the same methods at the present time.
I would be a little bit skeptical of that kind of analysis, in part because the 17 just sounds way too high. Secondly, historically, the figure of 25% is a rough approximation. There were no data that were anything like the data available today. And one last thing, as important as the absolute numbers are, even the absolute percentages, what really matters in terms of people's perceptions in the direction of politics is the rate of change in the data, so that nobody knows exactly what the unemployment rate was in 1929, say at the tail end of the boom, because it really never occurred to anybody to ask or to keep those statistics. But it was quite apparent that unemployment had increased dramatically between then and 1933. And I'll say one last thing about the incomparability of data. In a certain respect, the unemployment rates of the 1930s understate the impact on society, because in those days, the workforce consisted to a much greater degree of men. Women didn't participate in the paid workforce anywhere near to the degree they do today. As a result of this, most families were one-earner families. And so if that one earner lost typically his job, it meant the entire family was without work. These days, there are many more families that have two wage earners. And so if one person loses his or her job, it often means, not always, but it often means that there is another income earner in the family. And so the entire income of the family hasn't been wiped out. But a lot of this just has to do with the direction that things are going. And I would suggest from a political standpoint, if we get to 12% unemployment, that will seem to be as painful as the 25% in the Great Depression.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Historian and biographer H.W. Brands is our guest this afternoon. He's the author most recently of Traitor to His Class, The Privileged Life and Radical Presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Let's go on and take another call now. A listener in Savoy, line three, hi.
Hello. We had been talking a little bit about the impact of the war regards to the economy as far as the Iraq war versus wars in the past, and I think it's not so much the magnitude of the wars is the nature of war in general. It takes a lot less manpower to be effective now than it did, obviously, during World War II. And the government-issued items for members of past wars, things like deodorant or toothpaste, toothbrushes, socks, that type of thing, was quite expensive. And now our soldiers have to buy toiletries and things of that nature, but using their own money, so obviously that limits the manufacturing power involved with wars. I'm a hippie of sorts and a pretty big environmentalist, and I don't foresee any world war as far as country to country, but certainly a war on the carbon footprint of human beings on Earth is something that could be a global effort. As far as manufacturing green-type energy products, do you think a global effort and those initiatives would provide the economic spending punch that you had been talking about?
I'd love to be able to say yes, because I fully endorse those kind of policies, but historically I can't. I can't confidently say that. There is something in human nature that responds better to threats than it does to promises. And sure, you could say that the threat to the environment, global warming, is something that people could respond to. Well, in that regard, I would add sort of a corollary to this. People respond to crises better than they respond to distant threats. And the trouble with global warming, if people are going to perceive it as a threat, is that it's not something that, unless you address it now, 6 weeks from now, you are going to feel the pain. In the case of global warming, if you don't address it now, 6 weeks from now, you won't be able to tell the difference. It's only going to have an impact over 6 years or six decades, perhaps. And at least the American political system is very inadequate at dealing with those kinds of threats. You see it with complaints over the Social Security system and how it will be insolvent in 35 or 4 years. We have a very short time horizon in American politics. Members of the House of Representatives get elected every 2 years. So unless the payoff comes between now and the next election, it's very hard to mobilize support for it. Members of the Senate, 6 years, which is quite a short time frame with respect to these global issues. The other thing is that to be able to identify the enemy, to address these threats to the national security in traditional forms, is a much surer bet to mobilize the entire nation behind something or other. Because as I suggested earlier, if there's a clear threat after Pearl Harbor, no one could oppose greater spending on the military because the country was at war. And American traditions say that during war, you spend whatever is necessary to win and to win as quickly as possible. And so it became impossible for skeptics of government spending to say, you know what, we shouldn't spend that much. Whereas issues like global warming, it's perfectly politically credible for opponents of higher government spending to say either we don't need that particular program or there is a sufficient backlash and backfire against global warming that people can and are choosing their statistics and saying, no, no, it's not the problem that you say it is. Or they can say, well, even if it is a problem, it's not a crisis. Or even if it is a crisis, your particular solutions aren't the best way to deal with it. So there is no consensus regarding how to deal with something like global warming. I wish there was, but there's not. As soon as this nation goes to war, immediately there's a consensus behind the value of spending more money on national security.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited for our guest, H.W. Brands, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The book's prologue tells the story of Roosevelt at the time of the attack on Pearl Harbor. How did you make that choice to tell that story at the outset of the book?
I wanted to unite the two important, call it chapters, of Roosevelt's presidency. Roosevelt's first term dealt almost exclusively with domestic affairs. During his second term, he began to turn increasingly to foreign affairs because he believed the emerging threat of fascism in Europe and of militarism in Japan required the United States, in particular the president, to deal with that. But it took him a long time to get Americans to appreciate the threat. And it wasn't indeed until Pearl Harbor that Americans finally came around to something that Roosevelt had concluded years before, that the United States needed to pay close attention to what was going on in the rest of the world. I mentioned earlier that Roosevelt's presidency was radical in transforming American expectations of government at home. After Roosevelt, people would expect the government to tend to the economy, to deal with the damaging side effects of an economic downturn, to do something to prevent these from recurring again. In the case of foreign affairs, the radical transformation was equally dramatic. Roosevelt inherited a political system that was almost incurably isolationist. Americans during the mid-1930s, remembering their bad experience of the First World War and the years after the war, took the view that whatever happened in the rest of the world meant nothing to them. That if Europe wanted to go to hell in a handbasket, they would let it do it. If Europe was going to go to war again, the United States would stay out. The United States had gotten involved in Europe's war in the 1910s, and the outcome had been decidedly unsatisfactory for the United States, so Americans would not do it again. Roosevelt thought that was quite short-sighted. But he also understood that changing that view would require a long, protracted process of public re-education. So Roosevelt's second term was devoted to this kind of public re-education. He broached the idea that the United States might, the term that he used was quarantine the aggression. Even this was more than some of the isolationists were willing to stand, and Roosevelt had to back off. He gradually increased American assistance to Britain after Britain went to war with Germany. He took the bolder step of running for a third term in 1940. He believed that, well, like most people who attain positions of great power, he came to believe that his own political fate was wrapped up in the fate of the nation. And he believed that he was the best placed person to lead the country through this international crisis. I happen to think he was right, and in fact, most Americans agreed. But the culmination of this process of re-education came on the day of Pearl Harbor, when the Japanese attacked and immediately convinced those remaining skeptics that Roosevelt had been right, that the United States needed to deal with these international threats, because they wouldn't simply be threats to other countries. If they were threats that were large enough, eventually they would come to the United States. And this was the moment in Roosevelt's political career that linked his domestic presidency with his leadership in the Second World War. And so it really is, I happen to think, it's a very dramatic moment in Roosevelt's life, and it's a watershed in American history. The country has never been the same since. And in fact, when I make this argument there that Roosevelt's presidency was radical in these two respects, the strongest evidence that I can adduce in support of this is that the country has never seriously reconsidered the two conclusions it drew during Roosevelt's presidency. First, that it expects more out of government at home, and secondly, it expects more out of the United States in the world at large. Not since Roosevelt's death in 1945 have Americans seriously gone back on the idea that the government has to play a large role in the economy. One of the best evidences of this is last summer, when the financial system began to seize up, Republicans, as well as Democrats, immediately said, the government has to step in. In Herbert Hoover's day, that wasn't a role for government, but ever since Franklin Roosevelt's day, it has been. And the United States remains involved in the world. There are American troops in Afghanistan and in Iraq. In 1933, it never would have occurred to Americans that someday their troops would be fighting halfway around the world in other people's wars in the Middle East. But in fact, Americans now accept this as part of the responsibility of being the world's superpower.
When Franklin Roosevelt was a young lawyer, he looked around and said to himself, I think I don't want to do this. I don't want to be a lawyer. I want to go into politics. So he began his entrance into politics. How did he choose the Democratic Party?
Roosevelt's family were Democrats, and Roosevelt, by most measures, was a pretty conservative family guy. Now, interestingly, Roosevelt was a Democrat because his family were Democrats, but they lived in a part of New York that was predominantly Republican. His fifth cousin, Theodore Roosevelt, was just the opposite. Theodore Roosevelt was a Republican because his father was a Republican. And this despite the fact that they lived in predominantly Democratic New York City. So, in a certain respect, both Franklin Roosevelt and Theodore Roosevelt were these odd men out in their neighborhoods. And in other respects, they were kinds of difficult fits in their parties. Theodore Roosevelt was generally too progressive for the Republican Party. And as evidence of this, he had to bolt the party in 1912 when the Republicans denied him the nomination, even though he was clearly the most popular of the Republican candidates, and he ran on the ticket of the Progressive or Bull Moose Party. Franklin Roosevelt was president of the more progressive party, that's certainly true. But the Democratic Party in those days was this uncomfortable coalition of big city ethnics and political machines and very conservative, not to say reactionary, white Southerners. And so Roosevelt's politics were as far removed from the politics of the good old boys in the South as could be. But nonetheless, they were part of his Democratic coalition. They kept him from pushing the New Deal as far as it might have gone, especially on subjects like race relations. Roosevelt did very little explicitly for African Americans during the 1930s. And in fact, he often resisted efforts for the federal government to take a larger role. His wife, Eleanor, who was much more progressive on civil rights than Franklin was, advocated that the administration support a federal anti-lynching law. Roosevelt refused. And the reason he refused was that he knew that if he took that position, he would lose the support of all of those Southern senators whose support he required. It was in the nature of Southern and national politics that when the Democrats were in the majority in the Senate, the principal committees in the Senate were controlled. Their chairmen were these white Southerners who were in a position to bottle up any legislation Roosevelt wanted on any topic, let alone civil rights. So Roosevelt took this deliberate decision that if I push civil rights, I'm going to endanger everything else. And he said, on balance, for the ordinary people of this country, including African Americans, it's more important to get legislation on, say, a farm bill, or it's important to get the Civilian Conservation Corps, or it's important to get the WPA or Social Security passed, and to leave a federal anti-lynching law, to leave civil rights reform for a later generation. And that's precisely what he did, despite the complaints of Eleanor Roosevelt, his wife, who kept prodding him to do more.
We only have a couple minutes left here. There's so much material here. But to wrap up here, let's talk a little bit. Would you talk a little bit about Eleanor's evolution as a public wife and later as a political figure? She was at the beginning, she was shy and in the shadow of her husband. What happened? Maybe talk about Lucy Mercer and what role she played in the evolution of Eleanor Roosevelt.
The Eleanor Roosevelt story is one of the most fascinating stories in American politics. The title of my book originally was going to be Franklin and Eleanor, and it was going to be a dual biography of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. Now, my publisher vetoed that particular title because the publisher wanted to market the book as a presidential biography. And publishers do have this veto right over titles. The book, however, remains a dual biography of Franklin and Eleanor. And I spend a lot of time explaining how it was that Eleanor emerged into the political power she became. By 1945, in fact, until her death in 1962, Eleanor Roosevelt was the most powerful woman in American politics. But her political evolution was both a political evolution and a personal evolution. And it was personal in the sense of her identity alone, but also her relationship with Franklin Roosevelt. And it was a relationship that was fraught with all sorts of emotional distress, with emotional hope. It combined the difficulties of any marriage with the peculiar difficulties of this particular marriage, starting with the fact that Eleanor Roosevelt was an orphan who felt very unloved, unlovely, and unlovable. And she was rescued from what she thought would be spinsterdom by Franklin Roosevelt, who was this charming Galahad on a shining steed almost. And it really took her breath away. And it's obviously we don't have time to go through the whole thing, but yeah, she became, in certain respects, the conscience of the New Deal. And it was a role that Franklin Roosevelt encouraged her to take, even as he understood, and as she understood, that he wasn't going to be able to do all that she thought he ought to be doing. So there was a personal estrangement for a time during the relationship. The personal side grew warmer as each appreciated the strengths of the other. But there was always this undercurrent of tension. And to some extent, the tension was what gave rise to the energy that Eleanor invested in her political projects.
And another quick question and quick answer. The polio that struck Roosevelt, it affected not only Franklin Roosevelt, it also affected Eleanor. Did that shape her in her personal and political life as much as it did Franklin?
In short, the answer is yes, because When Franklin was stricken with polio and confined to a wheelchair, Eleanor had to do much more for him in politics than she had done before. And in fact, one of the things she did for him was to tell him that no, he was not going to retire from politics. She knew that she didn't want him around the house. There was also the business that if he did retire from politics, he was going to go live with his mother, and she didn't want to live with her mother-in-law. So she pushed him out into politics, and she became his spokesman. She became not exactly his eyes and ears, but his legs. When he couldn't walk around the places, she became his inspector general, and that's what led to her great interest and contributions to politics.
Yeah, and Sarah Roosevelt is another story entirely.
Another story entirely.
For another day.
Yes.
Well, H.W. Brands, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Celeste, it was my pleasure.
H.W. Brands is the author most recently of Traitor to His Class, The Privileged Life and Radical Presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.